Hrachovec at our department. Herbert Hrachovec is a professor of philosophy at the Department of Philosophy, University of Vienna, and his broad interests include analytic philosophy, metaphysics, aesthetics, and currently philosophy of new media. His latest publication is entitled Platons ungleiche Erben, Bildung und Datenbanken. Platons unequal heirs. Education and databases. I asked Professor Hrachovec for a topic from the German philosophy of the 20th century. He came with a talk on Heidegger and social consequences of his philosophy. After the talk, you can ask a question in German or in English, and the slides or the presentation and the recording of the talk will be available online next week. So, please.
So, thanks for inviting me, and thanks for having me and listening to what I have to say. I have come up with a bit of a fancy title. I mean, the basic title was Heidegger and Generalplan Ost. I wonder if you know about Generalplan Ost. Does it ring a bell? Anyone familiar with Generalplan Ost? So you are, or is it just common knowledge?
I think it's just common knowledge.
It is common knowledge. Okay.
I think from my point of view.
Yes. Okay. That's the first thing I'm learning, because Generalplan Ost was something I only became to know and look into detail at a very late stage. It's not something that is mentioned in the German or Austrian context. So this is the title that was given to you. I came up with a little bit of a different title, a more adventurous title, The River Told Me. I wonder if you know where this quote comes from. No, this is a quote which is more familiar to me. It's from The Doors. The Doors is a pop group from the 60s, and they have a very beautiful and well-known song, The River Told Me. And the river I'm going to talk about quite a lot in this presentation is the Danube. And you can see why this, in a vague sense, you can see why this has to do with the Generalplan Ost, because the Danube is the second largest river in Europe, goes from west to east, which is not the ordinary way rivers go. In Europe, and it includes this. It has this important feature of including of connecting the West, the German and the Eastern European countries. Even so, the Czech Republic isn't directly involved, only indirectly with the Marsh, things like that. So one of the main topics will be the Danube, the philosophical impact of the Danube, and the second big influence that we have to talk about when we talk about Heidegger and the Danube and the relationship to the East is Hölderlin. Hölderlin has written a poem which is called The Ister. It's written in 1800, and it is his vision of the Danube and the importance of the Danube, and he has some very impressive and highly charged observations on the Danube, and Heidegger has given a lecture on Hölderlin's the Ister hymn in 1942, and this is one of the main sources I'm going to refer to in treating the topic I have announced. Now there will be four subdivisions in what I have to say. The first subdivision is some texts from Being and Time, Heidegger's important book from 1927, And in particular, I will talk about the relationship of care and guilt. Care is the English translation of the German Sorge, which is a terminus technicus with Heidegger, and I'm going to point out some insights that Heidegger himself articulated in 27 before the whole political catastrophe really started. Second subsection, I will bring two examples, from Heidegger's philosophy, where Heidegger himself sort of plays or risks dealing with this relationship between care and guilt. And I will not, after the first section, I will not talk about guilt. It's a bit too ethically charged. I will talk about transgression. Transgressions that Heidegger himself is systematically building into his work as a philosopher. And then I will deal with the Easter and the particular kind of transgression that one can observe with Heidegger's interpretation of Hölderlin and the Easter and the role of the Danube. And this is when the Generalplan Ost comes in, because Heidegger's transgression will turn out to be a transgression which is uncomfortably close related to the Generalplan Ost, which I will show you in some more detail. Please, if something is completely mysterious to you, or you want just to have a clarification, don't hesitate to interrupt me. I mean, the more substantial discussion will take place after the talk, but if there is a need for you to come up with something which is confusing you, you shouldn't hesitate to jump in. Now, first section, care and guilt. I am taking this out of being and time without any consideration of what being and time is all about. Probably the most important main concept of being and time is Sorge. And Sorge is something which Heidegger calls the formal existential totality of the ontological structural whole of Dasein. He is a very talented wordsmith, so to say. His language is rich and full of allusions and neologisms. Basically, what he's saying is, if you want to talk about the most elemental features of human existence, it is besorgtsein, it's caring, and this caring is not—it's not care like a patient's care or elderly care. It's a care in the sense of being concerned with aims, being concerned with the world, that with all those things that are encountered in the world, and to care for oneself. What is it that I want to do? What is it? What is the aim of my life? Heidegger develops this as a very general framework of being in the world. Man in the world is caring for himself, for the world, for all the other men that are in the world, and this is a network. It's a sort of an all-encompassing network. And within this all-encompassing network, there are two modes. One mode is you can just let it go. You can let it happen. You can drift, and this is okay. In some way, it's okay. Ontologically, it's neutral. You can drift, and this is that you are letting yourself drift. Does not mean you are out of care. It's just one way you care about the world. The second one is characterized by freedom. And so the one is the inauthentic, that's the drifting. And the other one is characterized by freedom, which is you take responsibility for your own life and for those of your environment, your friends or enemies in your environment, and this is a very clear conscious decision. It's the authentic mode of being. Now, in this authentic mode of being, you are forced to make decisions. And those decisions are not decisions you can calculate, these are not decisions that are clinically clean or something, where you can have the certainty that you are on the right on the right side of a confrontation or something like this. It is always the case that you are within some muddle. You want to cope. You have to cope, and sometimes you make mistakes, and sometimes you do something wrong. And since you are a being which is characterized by freedom, guilt in coming to the wrong conclusions, doing the wrong decisions. Guilt is part of what your being is about. This is what Heidegger is arguing in Being and Time. And to add even more emphasis to this idea, it's not just that guilt happens, that shit happens as it is. You cannot avoid it. Heidegger is insisting on the fact that you have to accept being guilty as part of your being. You can't escape this. That's not what philosophy is about. And he says, and that's something I will come back to in the end of this talk, Heidegger on the one hand tries to develop his ontological analysis as something completely neutral, just sketching the most general features of human existence. And then he asks himself, well, if I do this, isn't it the case that I myself are part of the environment, I am in some way myself guilty. What I am telling you is also coming from a particular historical situation. And should I? How should I react to this? How should I deal with this? And Heidegger says we should not hide this. We should, in fact, accept that even as philosophers wanting to do ontological analysis of what humankind is about, we are part of history and we are guilty, and we should not deny this. It must not be denied, and we are forced to grant. It is to be understood as a positive necessity. We have to face this sort of presuppositions that we are here letting themselves be introduced into our analysis. Now, I'll give you two examples of how Heidegger himself was, now it's a matter of interpretation, is playing with, or he's a very provocative guy, I'll have to tell you, and he likes to provoke. And those two examples that I'll show you are highly provocative, and the third one, which will lead me to the NRI Plan Ost, it's not only highly provocative, it's immensely provocative, it's shockingly provocative. And this provocation has to be, my message here is not to tell you he's an enormously provocative guy. I want to show you how it develops from his own philosophy, and how one should recognize that this is part of his philosophy. It's not just his being a Nazi at this particular time, or afterwards an unrepentant right-wing philosopher. Now, the first transgression, provocation, that I will briefly show you is in his inaugural address, which he gave in 1933. It's well known. He was at this time advocating the Führer. He was advocating that the German nation fulfill its historical mission, which is to know, to fight for, to stand in for the essence of German university. And so this is a very upbeat and exhortative talk. I will not go into these details here. I'll show you the end of this talk. And the end of this talk is the following quote, and that I will read you that. We do will ourselves for the young and the youngest strengths of the people, which already reaches beyond us, have now decided the matter. And then, so he says, the German nation will assist Hitler, will go with Hitler all the way, but we should not forget that the German nation and the German thinking is closely connected to Greek antique philosophy thinking and to Plato and the far-reaching thoughtfulness that gave ancient Greek wisdom the world. So the Greek Plato, it's a Plato quote, which he is quoting at the end of his talk, and it's Ta megala panta episphale, and then he adds the German translation, and the German translation is as it would have been in Mein Kampf, all that is great stands in the storm. It's a very impressive Wagnerian, if you want to, quote that he gives. It's only that it's not a translation at all. It's not a translation of Ta megala panta episphale, because sphalo, the Greek sphalo, means to sway, to reel, to be uncertain, and episphale is swaying, reeling, it's blown by the wind. So what Plato is actually saying is everything that is great is blowing in the wind. And here you have Heidegger telling his audience in the Freiburg, you have to imagine, the Freiburg auditorium stuffed with all those philologists and things like that. You have Heidegger tell them all that this great stands in the storm. So, I mean, it would be funny if it wasn't as heavily charged politically. That is what he, in some way, you have this example that he just wants to show it to them. He just wants to trick them in something. It's not my aim to interpret what he was up to here, but this is a matter of historical facts. First of all, that these are the words he said. They are printed, they are authenticated by Heidegger himself, and they are simply not Plato. So that's one of the first transgression I wanted to show you. Now the second transgression is that's closer to Hölderlin, and I'm going to talk a bit about Hölderlin, and it is dealing. These are tiny, very charged details that I'm talking to you. And Heidegger is quite often his way of thinking is doing funny stuff with those tiny details. And those tiny details they will have to do with what's here. That's facsimile of Hölderlin, Wie wenn am Feiertag, a hymn of Hölderlin. And I'll come back to that. The transcription of this facsimile is here, given in the Frankfurter Ausgabe, which by Dieter Sattler faithfully transcribes every single word and parentheses and all of that that you have just seen. And what you have seen is here, sind schuldlos unsere Hände. Our hands are without guilt. That's Hölderlin. Now, this is the basis, the material basis of what Heidegger turns into another, let's call it game, provocative game. And the situation is like this. I'm talking about a talk he was giving. It's published in Erläuterungen zu Hölderlins Dichtung. I think it's from 1940. No, it's not from 1943. It's from 1943. And then in this talk, he mentions the following thing. He says, using the handwritten drafts, Norbert von Hellingrad first gave the poem a form and published it in 1900. You can imagine that there is some sense in putting it like this. This is unfinished work. Hellingrad gave this poem a form, which is he made it ready. He came up with a version that could be published as something Hölderlin wrote. Even so, as you can see here, it's quite unclear what the final stage of Hölderlin's development would have been. So he did give some form to this, and the form that Hellinghardt gave was: Denn sind nur reinen Herzens, wie Kinder wir, sind schuldlos unsere Hände, colon. And the reason Hellinghardt gives a colon here is because according to any ordinary reading, the sentence is continued. The sentence is continued here. Even so, Hölderlin neglects to write a colon up there. Now here we go with Heidegger's game playing. He says, I'm going to give you a text, and this text is not entirely the Hellinghardt text. I have checked it against the original manuscripts. That's actually a wrong English translation here, that what we mentioned. He says, nach den urschriftlichen Entwürfen erneut geprüft, which means I looked it up again in the original. And that this doesn't mean repeatedly checked against. Repeatedly would mean he looked several times. So that's a pretty awkward mistake here. Anyway, what he does say is, I looked it up in the original, and from there I constituted a text which is based on my interpretation. The text rests upon the following attempt at an interpretation. So what he tells you is, never mind what Hölderlin actually wrote, I've got an interpretation, and the text that I'm going to show you is resting on the following attempt at an interpretation. And what he means is, and you can see it here, and it's very cute, the comma that Hellinghardt and Sinkernagel placed after the word hands, that's the comma, does not appear in the original manuscript. Correct, as you have seen. Now, with line 36, a thought begins, which returns to the saying of the holy and introduces the consummation of the poem. Line 36, this is line 36. So what he says is, here, these are the last three lines that Hellinghardt gave, and Heidegger says, in these three lines there is something completely new happening, and if you have a comma here, that gives you the impression that it's just a continuation, but I tell you there has to be something new happening, and because I know from my interpretation that there is something completely new happening, I will put a full stop here. Which he does. So his version is, wie Kinder wir sind schuldlos unsere Hände, full stop. Des Vaters Strahl der Reine versenkt es nicht. Now, this turns the whole issue, and it's similar to the Plato stuff he does. It turns on the referent of this S. I will not go into those details. You'll get the slides, and you can, if you want to, check up or write me a letter. I've written on this, even I have to admit this in German. So what he is doing is he's being rough with the facts. Let's put it in a mild way. Now my third section now approaches the Donau, the Ister, and the Generalplan. And here again you have the topology that we are talking about. In order to introduce what Heidegger is up to, I'll have briefly to give you one of the most important ideas that he has in this lecture on the Ister. And he is putting this in a very picturesque and idiosyncratic language, but the idea is an interesting one, and one that one can really profit from, I think. And as the sort of summary of what Heidegger is wanting to do, is I put it like this: places where rivers run. If you think about what a river is, a river, very generally, has these interesting characteristics that we, in some way, we have. It is a place. It's a particular place. We say Vienna, it's on the Danube. Köln is on the Rhine. Praha is on the Moldau, Vltava. So it's a place where people live. And this place where people live is designated by the river, so it's the locality. He's talking about locality. And on the other hand, rivers, very different from mountains, for example, that rivers, mountains don't move. They just stick there. St. Anton am Arlberg, the Arlberg is always the Arlberg. And the rivers have, they run. So rivers are in some way vectors. That's not a word Heidegger would use. They are going somewhere, coming from somewhere and going somewhere. So they open up a landscape while at the same time designating a particular locale. And this is what Heidegger makes quite a lot of when he talks about locality of dwelling of human beings and at the same time journeying, which is the outreach, which is to go off someplace else. And he keeps repeating several times in his lecture, the river is the locality of journeying, yet the river is also the journeying of locality. If you've never encountered journeying in English, I don't think it's a coincidence, because there is nothing like this. It's a word designed to capture Wanderschaft that Heidegger is talking about. Now, up to here, it's interesting, it's in some ways clean. Now, there is a second feature of rivers that can happen with rivers, and in particular with the Danube. And Hölderlin used this particular feature of the Danube, which is there can be these slings in rivers. That's not actually the sling that Hölderlin was had in mind. He didn't see that. It's in Upper Austria. But the peculiarity of this sling, one peculiarity that you can make something out of if you are writing a poem in a very exalted spirit, is that in this segment here, so this is east, this towards the west, and if you look at this segment, the river seems to come from the east. It's just reversing its own course, and this is something that Hölderlin... So these are two particular observations that are in Hölderlin and that Heidegger builds upon. They are in Hölderlin's Ister. Hier aber wollen wir bauen. Here, so we want to build. This is the locality. This is homeland, this is where people live their life. And then there is this other, I think it must come from the east, which is Hölderlin. And with Hölderlin, it is his general design that Germany and the old Greek poets and philosophers had a very close relationship, and the Danube, which is a characteristically German river, seems to come from the east. So the inspiration for the German river seems to, in some way, to be connected with the east. The east, the Black Sea, is not just its destination. German history is motivated by Greek influence, and the Danube itself seems to come from the east. So this is the Hölderlin idea. And now you have Heidegger coming in and doing his own stuff with these Hölderlin ideas. What is one's own in this case is whatever belongs to the fatherland of the Germans. This coming to be at home in one's own, in itself, entails that human beings are initially and for a long time and sometimes forever not at home. And this is, again, it's comparatively clean. What he wants to say is, in interpreting Hölderlin, we have our Danube in Germany or in Austria, but it's not enough to have the locality of the river in Austria. We have to recognize that being at home is always also involved with the strangers, with the strangeness, and the fact that the Danube seems to come from the east is a signal. It shows that we have to confront ourselves with the east. In the case of Hölderlin, it is Greece, and Heidegger, of course, wants to do that too. And so what we have to do is we have to understand our particular place in history. We have to have an Auseinandersetzung, an encounter with those strangeness, with the strangeness from the east. And it has to be brought into a relationship with our home fatherland of the Germans. Now, what I'm writing here, that's the official English translation, the law of the encounter. That's where those, where the homeliness and the strangeness meet. In this translation itself, they give the original German, which is Auseinandersetzung for encounter. And this is now the place where I want to put my finger onto this particular expression as the third kind of transgression that I want to show you. The first quote here is from the translator's note of Hölderlin's hymn. The term Auseinandersetzung is sometimes translated as confrontation. In the present course, however, its meaning seems less polemic and it carries more of the sense of a dialogical exchange or encounter between the two parties, the strange parties and the German parties. And this is fair enough for the Easter hymn, because the place where Heidegger is talking about Auseinandersetzung is when he starts relating Hölderlin to Sophocles. So his lecture is built up as a dialogue between the German poet Hölderlin and Sophocles, the drama of the Greeks. So in some way there is a dialogical situation. But, and this is from the Elucidations, which is 1 year later than the Easter, and there is quite another Heidegger, which is not the Heidegger of the dialogue between the great poets and thinkers, but which is the Heidegger of Nazi Germany. And there is an almost unbelievable quote from his Elucidations on Hölderlin. In 43, you have to imagine at this time, Stalingrad is about to happen, or has already happened.
Has already happened.
And obviously, Stalingrad is the reason for that. And what he says, and this is in the course of interpreting Hölderlin, he says the following: "Are not the sons of the homeland, who so far distant from its soil, still gaze into the gaiety of the homeland, shining towards them, and devote and sacrifice their life for the still reserved find? Are not these sons of the homeland the poet's closest kin?" So what he says is that the German soldiers fighting in the east, having conquered the east, having done whatever, all they did in the east, and dying now because they cannot uphold their aggression anymore, those are sacrificing their lives for the homeland. And not only are they dying, they are the closest kin of the poem of Hölderlin. The poet's Hölderlin closest kin, you have to realize, as an aside, devote and sacrifice their life is is a very civil translation, a very civilized and standard translation of what Heidegger is actually saying. In German, it is ihr Leben verwenden und im Opfergang verschwenden. This is incredible. I mean, first of all, it's Wagnerian in this Kurt Binnenreim, verwenden und verschwenden. Sacrificial Opfer, sacrifice. It's not just sacrifice, it's an Opfergang, which is a ritual of sacrifice. Anyway, so this is, even so the translator is right with Auseinandersetzung in the case of Sophocles and Hölderlin, at the same time, there is a good reason to read Heidegger's Auseinandersetzung also as referring to the military, militaristic and aggressive Auseinandersetzung to the East. And now to show you that Heidegger's talking about reaching out to the East and sacrificing and all of this is not just Heidegger, but it is heavily related to the way people, the Nazi official language went. Now I'll show you some contemporary pictures. So here you have the map in 1940, where the following, with this inscription is the following one. I have translated it for you. Simultaneously with the victories on the battlefield, the German people has, out of the fullness of its power, carried out one of the greatest projects known to mankind, the homecoming of hundreds of thousands of fellow Germans. But the great political events of 1940 also have repercussions upon the inner strengths of the German ethnic groups remaining outside the confines of the Reich. Now here you have this double movement already. You have the expansion, you have the victories on the battlefield of the German people, and you have the here we are going to build, coming back to Germany and coming home, hundreds of thousands of Germans are coming home, and at the same time this coming home strengthens and assists people outside the confines of the Reich. That's one example. Second example, again, colors are not as bright here, but here you see how you have to understand the consolidation and the reconquest of the East from the view of the German Reich. It says the following, this text here says the following: after the 18 days expedition, the most lavish resettlement of human history began. They are always in top categories. All ethnic groups that had fulfilled their duties out there were recalled by the Führer back to the homeland of their fathers. Here again you have the East coming, the Germans from the East coming back to the West. They are now assisting with the building and consolidation of the German Empire. The second wave of conquest in building of the Wartegau, their colonial skills will become particularly effective. The Wartegau, you have to know, is Poland. Poland is the Warsaw area, and this is what these are the official documents that sort of stabilized, conceptualized, and organized this sort of thinking, colonial thinking, German colonization of the East. It is called the Generalplan Ost. It has been preserved. By the way, there is a facsimile of the Generalplan Ost, 100 pages or so, at this particular URL. And language that is used is neue Besiedlungsformen zu finden. Since the East is now penetrated by German life, we have to find new ways of settlement, and you have this absolutely transcendent quote of Himmler, where he, that is in one of his secret talks he gave in 42, precisely the same year that Heidegger was giving his Easter lecture. The war makes no sense if afterwards Bohemia and Moravia, German Eastern districts, and so on and so on, aren't completely settled with Germans within 20 years. The land is Germanized when the populace is German. And you have you have here the plan, ländliche Siedlung, städtische Siedlung, Schaffung von Siedlungsmarken, settlements. This is the colonial plan that the Nazis had, and which is... and I cannot help myself, I just put it before you, this innocent Hölderlin quote of "Hier lasst uns bauen," here we want to build, this is here, here we want to settle, is in Heidegger's view, it is closely connected with the Siedlungsbewegung. This is the map as the Germans imagined it. They had three Gaus here in the Leningrad area. This is the Wartegau here, and this is the so-called Gotengau. It's a Crimea and upstairs, just to give you an example, which by the way, legitimizes in some way the fact that I'm talking about the Danube, because the Gotengau is that's the Dnieper here, but it's in the area, it's in the general area of the Danube too. Now this is how the Germans imagined their new colonized settling. Hier lasst uns bauen, and here is Königsberg. In case you're a little bit confused about this map. So this is the these are the eastern districts that Germans wanted to colonize with this type. These are original sketches and models here with this type of building. Now, here are just for historical reasons some reminders of what was going to happen there. Together with settlers from other Germanic countries, the authors of the Generalplan Ost expected to have 10 million persons for colonizations in the eastern territories. And of course, the Jews had to be eradicated, and the Slav population had to be displaced. And this is what settling, Siedlung meant in the contemporary situation. And now this is my concluding evidence, again without simply accusing Heidegger of something, just putting the evidence before you. Heidegger in his Easter, he talks about locality and journeying a lot, and there is no embarrassing quote like the one from the Viven am Feiertag, poet, the soldiers of, and the kings of the poets. But there is at about I missed the page number here. I'll have to add this. It's about 48. I think it's in 48 in the English translation. Suddenly, at the end of part one of this lecture, he is using the word Siedlung, settlement, again. And it is almost unimaginable that using Siedlung Siedlung und Wiederbesiedlung, settlement and resettlement, here, settlement and resettlement, using it in this, at this time, in this context, using it has to refer to the activities that I've been sketching. So this is a part of the evidence. You can make your own rhyme. I have to add one more thing, which points to the fact that almost nothing with Heidegger is as easy as it looks, because at the same time, when he mentions settlement and resettlement, he adds another twist, which might, if you are trying to argue in favor of him, you could use this fact, and it's the following one. He is building up an opposition between grasping the expansionary, the aggressive, the churning view of the matter, which takes hold of and takes possession of something. That is something that he recognizes, and it is clearly, according to his philosophy, a feature of the modern age, that people want to possess, that people want to escalate their power, upon nature, but also the power for Lebensraum. So this is the Nazi aggression. And then he asks himself whether it is not the case that this sort of aggression has a counter move, and settlement is a counter move, a move towards being bound to a place. And in one way, what I pointed out to you in pointing to those posters, the contemporary Nazi posters, the relationship between aggression and settlement was a relationship of dialectical necessity. You have to have both. First you conquer, then you send the peasants, the people to colonize the land. So the new land that you just conquered will be part of your own homeland. So settlement and conquest are the same, are the same two views of the same issue, more or less. So this would be the message of our people out there. They taught us how to colonize, so we go out and colonize some more. But Heidegger has a second option, and this is in the paragraph immediately following the first one. And this is in this second option, he distinguishes two kinds of settling. So he has one settlement, which is the bad settlement, so to speak, between the grasping. Here's the grasping. The grasping that extends towards world domination, so that's the aggressive, and the movement of settlement subservient to such domination. So this is one, that's one part of the conjunction here. So the settlement in some way is included in the grasping. This is what I just tried to outline. Heidegger himself is conceding as much. And on the other hand, human beings coming to be at home via churning and locality. So this is the good settlement. This is a settlement outside wanting to grasp. This is going to be one of his main ideas after the breakdown of the German Nazi rule, when in the 50s and 60s he talked about coming to be at home via churning and locality, conveniently forgetting that that this sort of coming to be at home used to be settlement in the sense that I outlined. Now this is my last slide here, and it's a repetition mostly of what I showed you in the first section. It reminds us of the fact that philosophy will never seek to deny its presuppositions. The historical situation in which Heidegger worked brings with it this particular intertwining between care and guilt. Now, one more sentence that I left out the first time around. Philosophy conceives of those presuppositions and develops with more and more penetration both the presuppositions themselves and that for which they are presuppositions, which is presumably the thing we have to do. Thank you very much for your attention.